Hello, it's Wednesday 28th of April. I'm Hannah Pearson from Pear Anderson. On today's show, Gary Bowerman of Check In Asia and I will debate some of the biggest questions in travel and tourism. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today we've decided to take on some of the big picture talking points in travel and tourism. With the COVID-19 pandemic now in its 14th month and showing no signs of retreating, what has the travel world learned and how will those lessons be or not be applied in future? So, Hannah, we've put together a list of questions to ask each other. You get the first go. So let's start with a big one. What do travel and tourism mean today? And do you have a different outlook than before the pandemic?
It's such a difficult question that, Gary. Thanks for putting me first to answer that. I think it's difficult to say, isn't it? But I think what is really clear is that everybody now really, really appreciates travel and tourism. It's that thing, isn't it? You don't know what you've got until it's gone. And that's certainly been true for many people. You know, everybody has been so restricted in terms of where they've been able to travel. You know, even here in Malaysia, we can't even travel interstate. So, you know, the question now is, do you even need to go away somewhere to count that as travel? You know, is just taking a staycation, is just going to visit a museum in your backyard, is that tourism? It kind of is now. It kind of counts this year. And I think that's forced us to re-examine how necessary it actually is to travel long distances to be called travel. What do you think?
Yeah, I 100% agree with you that we have reconsidered what we took for granted before. You know, this buy and fly concept where you could literally just go online, book a flight, and go the same day if you wanted to anywhere that you know, particularly in our region, you could go anywhere several times a day. There were so many flights. I think what has become clear is there is a much greater separation of the terms travel and tourism. I think that has become much better understood, the reasons that people travel, that there are so many of them. And we've said this on the pod before, that perhaps governments didn't quite understand that separation of why travel and tourism are both very, very important, but they are distinctive concepts. I think one of the things that's definitely come into play right now, and we'll talk about this in some of the other questions, is just the massive complexity and the ancillary costs of traveling today. You know, that has completely changed. We were so used to, you know, being able to book very easily, being able to fly very easily. But there, you know, a lot of the bureaucracy that used to exist, particularly like entry visas, in many countries, they were being removed or reduced. You know, that's all coming right back again now. Borders remain closed in our region. You know, and that in itself, as you said, is like, how do we consider travel and tourism when we don't even have the liberty to travel? We don't have that right. And that is often enshrined in law. In many countries in the world now, it's actually illegal to travel. Australia is a very good case in point. They actually had to amend their legislation to enable Australians to travel to New Zealand as part of the travel bubble. So, you know, there's this whole legal barrier now to travel, which didn't exist before. And that's just adding to the complexity. And that is really making us rethink whether, you know, how in future we will travel, where we will go. And as you said, does that mean that, you know, taking a staycation now is going to become part of our lives in future? I'm really not sure.
Yeah. So looking back to January 2020, what do you think the biggest changes have been for the tourism industry? And are those going to be temporary or are any of them going to be permanent?
Well, the biggest change, quite obviously, is the fact that borders were closed and people were unable to travel. And that caused an almost total destruction of travel supply, didn't it? Whether that's airlines, whether that's trains, you know, whether that's cruise ships, whether that's hotels, the whole supply system was more or less destroyed for a year in many, many countries. And that's going to take a long time to work its way back again. We'll look at demand. You know, there are a lot of factors we're not sure about how travel demand will come back in future. It still comes back to that same question of becoming accustomed to the freedom and the ability to just travel whenever we wanted to, or whenever we were able to, or whenever our jobs required us to, or whenever we were going to study overseas, or whenever we were going to visit friends and family in other countries. You know, it just became part. It was integrated in modern lifestyles. You know, that phrase that AirAsia always uses, now everyone can fly, you know, it's a great logo, it's a great slogan, but actually it became true in our region. You know, more people than ever before were able to take vacations. They were able to go and study overseas. They were able to go and work overseas. There were so many reasons that people traveled. And I think, you know, that has all gone and we just don't know when that's coming back. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's like you're saying, that's mad, isn't it? You know, last year I took a trip to Singapore, just a day trip. I booked it maybe 2 days before the trip. That's not going to happen for, I don't even want to guess when, but not for a long, long time yet. I think for me, you know, some of the biggest change really in the travel industry, and it's very much a forced change on everybody, is this focus on domestic travel. Of course, before this, and I've said this before, you know, a lot of travel in a country, particularly in Southeast Asia, was focused on inbound tourists, on international tourists, rather than not necessarily what domestic tourists would want to do. So this had to be a whole redesign, a whole rethink around redesigning inbound tourism to suit domestic tourists. Now, is this going to be permanent? I don't know. The jury's still out. I think still in the short term, yes, definitely it's going to be there. I mean, we're going to see people do revenge spend travel, I think, once international borders do reopen. But, you know, if you look at what's going on economically, what's going on politically across the region, lots of people have had reduced incomes. They've maybe had to use their annual leave for childcare, just been forced to take it by work. There's this nervousness about traveling overseas. And, you know, vaccinations, perhaps people are unable to get them. Perhaps they're traveling with children. You're not going to be able to travel overseas anytime soon. So there is still going to be this focus on domestic travel, maybe for the next 2 to 3 years. But what happens beyond that is unclear. Are people then going to jump back at the chance to travel internationally? Maybe. And what we may see then is just these innovative domestic products being kind of readapted for the international market. So kind of feeding into that, which, of course, has a whole purpose and will be good to kind of get everybody excited again about traveling inbound. But yeah, it will be very interesting to see what happens with this whole focus about domestic travel.
Yeah, I agree. I think the interesting thing is, I think you said this on the podcast a while ago, you know, the governments have tended to use domestic travel in recent months, well, the last year, almost as a civic duty, you know, imploring people to travel in their own country to keep the travel industry afloat, to keep people in jobs and to keep the economy ticking over. But what we'll see is, as you said, there have been quite a lot of innovations in domestic travel in different countries in different ways, as you would expect. But how will those be strategized in future? You know, will domestic tourism actually be more enshrined in the way that domestic governments and tourism boards look at the whole travel picture? You would think that it probably should, but then you also look at the way that some countries, those that really rely on inbound travel, so you'd obviously look at Thailand there, probably Bali as well, although Bali has a very strong domestic sector. And there is definitely this move to get back international travel, inbound travel as quickly as possible, almost to the detriment of all the work that's been done in the domestic tourism sector. The problem with domestic tourism, as we know, this pertained before the pandemic and will be the same afterwards, is it's very patchy. You know, it tends to be long weekends, public holidays. You know, those tend to be the prime periods, whereas international travel is year round. So, you know, that's a problem that we actually came into the pandemic with. It's become more highlighted now. But how can governments actually look at encouraging people to travel at different times of the year, not just when they have public holidays? I think that's something that would be interesting if governments could actually take a really creative way of approaching that.
Yeah, you know, whether that's staggering school holidays across the country even, but I mean, I think that causes issues for other reasons, but that could be an issue or an option. And it would just be really fascinating to see what happens with Singapore. I mean, right now, Singapore has some really innovative things going on domestic tourism wise. But the minute the borders reopen, are Singaporean tourists still going to go for that? Are they still going to prefer to spend their money? And things are still expensive in Singapore. Don't forget, you know, they could probably holiday for cheaper overseas. Yeah, I think Singapore will be the one to keep an eye on to see how deeply entrenched this new trend for domestic tourism really is.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, Singapore is a kind of unique case, really, just because of the nature of its size, its geography, the fact it only has one airport, so you can't fly domestically there. But, you know, the interesting aspect, I guess, would be these cruises to nowhere, which have been just such a huge success. But once Singaporeans are able to travel overseas again, you know, will that market disappear? Will it dissolve? You know, will it be diluted? Will it still exist? These are the kind of things we don't really know whether they'll be temporary or permanent. You would imagine there will still be some demand for those, but obviously be a lot less than it has been over the past few months.
Yeah. So what do you think the most overlooked development has been so far, Gary?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's quite a difficult one to answer because, you know, travel and tourism has been in the spotlight over the past year, hasn't it? For all the economic reasons, all the personal reasons, all the reasons that we've discussed many times on the pod, it has become, you know, this sort of global case of how the pandemic is affecting everybody's lives, all the way across the travel chain and all the related businesses that, you know, are related to travel and tourism. I think probably the most overlooked development so far is one that we don't really yet know. And I think that's how the shifts in travel demand will take place in future. We don't know whether, you know, people will feel more reticent to travel in future, whether they will take less trips. As you said, there is very likely to be some sort of initial revenge spend. But, you know, that will also rely on the fact of whether destinations are safe. But when they travel to a destination for the first time, do they feel safe? Do they have a good experience? Or is there something that makes them uncertain or nervous, which means they might not travel again for a while? I think, you know, we got used to these year-round patterns of travel demand for all sorts of different types of travel. I'm not sure going forward that when borders reopen, and borders will probably only reopen in phases anyway, you know, whether that level of demand can be sustained to the level that it was before, not just because of the supply issues in travel, you know, whether there are enough numbers of flights, whether hotels are safe, those kinds of things, but just how people's perceptions about travel, lifestyle, and their own sort of human vulnerability will have changed. And I think in the back of people's minds will be that now that we've experienced one pandemic, it won't be the last and it could happen again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right, you know, about different travel periods. That's going to be really interesting because, of course, you have your peak seasons and your low seasons before. And how are people going to plan for those now? You know, are they going to be the same? How do you then go as a tour operator and plan even your staff's annual leave? Yeah, just logistically, it's going to be really difficult. It's just operating from completely unknown, I suppose. But that's what we've been doing for the last year anyway.
Yeah, I would say I would agree with that. But I mean, would you say that's the most overlooked development? What would be your thoughts?
Mine is testing, really. So it's more, I suppose, maybe not the most overlooked, but perhaps the most underrated development so far. Everybody's talking about vaccinations and how vaccinations are almost like the magical unicorn that's going to fix everything. But, you know, as we've talked before, and Dirk Singer from Simplifying was saying, you know, a few weeks ago, I think even Simon on our episode last week as well, testing is going to have to be around for a really, really long time. And there are some innovative things going on in different countries. So you've got Indonesia's Genos, which is a kind of breathalyzer test, super cheap, $1.40. You've got Philippines, you have the RT-PCR saliva test. Singapore announced last week that they're starting to trial a breathalyzer, Tracy X, at Changi's Terminal 1, and that apparently has 95% accuracy. And again, results, I think, back in about a couple of minutes. I think test costs are about $20. You know, for me, this is the development that is, it's hard to say exciting, because can you call a COVID test exciting? But these are going to be the game changers, I think. You know, once you manage to bring testing down to an affordable level, to something that happens painlessly, something that happens fast, we're going to be able to see that, I think, the control of COVID come down, people's confidence growing. You know, you're getting on, you know, say you undergo this test just before you go on a plane, you can be pretty confident then that everybody there at that point in time didn't have COVID, you know, just an hour before they get on board, as opposed to 48 hours or 72 hours. You know, we've, in the last week or so, we've seen so many news articles about Indian travelers turning up at different airports and testing positive And I guess that this is because of this 70, you know, often they only need tests with a validity of 72 hours. So within that 72 hours, they developed the symptoms and they became positive. So for me, it's testing. I think that is going to be the key to encourage more travel rather than necessarily vaccinations.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the interesting thing perhaps about testing is alongside the sort of scientific developments that you've mentioned there and, you know, bringing down the time to get results and that kind of thing is just how much testing is one of the new ancillary costs of travel. You know, whether you have to have tests before you fly, when you arrive, if you're in quarantine. I've been speaking to a few people recently that have been in quarantine. If you actually look at the checklist of costs that are involved in that, it's incredible. You know, it's not just the testing. It's not just the actual hotel stay. It's the quarantine stay. There are these unknown service charges, which, you know, just appear from nowhere. There are huge costs to travel at the moment. Most of those are obviously because of quarantines. And if quarantines are removed, that would take some of those out. But as you mentioned there, Hannah, you know, the costs of a test in Singapore or Philippines or Malaysia is very different than if you arrive at Heathrow. Like the costs for a PCR test at Heathrow are really, really expensive. And if you're traveling alone, perhaps you can bear that. But if you're traveling as a couple or as a family, now, those costs would really rack up. And I don't see those costs being borne by anybody else except the traveler for a long time. I'm sure that that is going to be a disincentive in terms of demand for travel going forward, because although it's going to make people feel more safe, it is going to hit you in the pocket.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Gary, we're end of April already. What have we learned in the first 4 months of 2021? And is the current outlook for the year different than what you expected it to be at the end of 2020?
Well, you know me, Hannah, I'm the eternal pessimist. So I wouldn't say it's a great deal different than at the end of 2020. You know, we went through a particularly difficult Northern Hemisphere winter. So there were case spikes in many countries in Asia, around the world. It was a difficult period. There were hopes that 2021 would bring vaccines, would bring new demand in travel, would bring borders being unlocked, but that hasn't happened at all. I think what we've learned over the first 4 months of this year is that some of the countries that we thought were safe, that had control of the virus, simply haven't. So you look at Thailand there, you look at Laos, you look at Cambodia. You know, they've had resurgent waves. I think this is the big thing we've learned, is that this pandemic is not called a pandemic for no reason. This virus is vicious and it keeps recurring. You look at what's happening in India right now and it's absolutely heartbreaking. It's very similar to what we saw in places like New York or Italy this time last year, but just on a much, much bigger scale. And I think the worry, this is one thing that scientists are talking about a lot at the moment, is just the scale and the pace of the spread of this virus in India really makes it vulnerable to new mutations, which could be more dangerous than before. So we certainly haven't seen the back of coronavirus, and that is going to impact travel and the way policymakers think about travel, I think, for the rest of the year. So I'm sorry to be so pessimistic, but I think what we've learned over the first 4 months is just how difficult it is going to be to get out of this situation. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you definitely about that. You know, virus variants, I think, are going to be the new thing that everybody is talking about this year. And we've seen just the impact of that, you know, on travel restrictions over the last week. So many countries around the world have suddenly closed their doors to India. So, you know, when you're thinking about reopening, it's not even about whether you're vaccinated or what level of COVID control you've got in the country, but it's also about what variants are circulating in your country too. And you as a traveler really have nothing. You can't control that. So it's just the luck of the draw, I suppose, in a way. I think what I've learned from the first 4 months of this year is just how difficult international coordination is still. You know, and I think I've ranted before about how governments have still not got their act together over mutually recognized vaccination passports, which is something you'd think that they would have had lined up months and months ago. But there's also this growing vaccine nationalism as well that I think is going to play into things. So China not recognizing any non-Chinese vaccines at the moment. You've got European countries not recognizing the Chinese vaccine. Iceland doesn't recognize the Russian vaccine. Things are going to get really, really complicated. And there's no kind of international consensus. And even if we're talking non-COVID, let's talk about Southeast Asia. I mean, the situation in Myanmar right now, which is completely shocking, completely awful. Yes, they had an ASEAN summit over the weekend, but did it really achieve anything? Not really. Is the world really achieving anything there either? Not really. It's quite hard to see how the world is going to kind of pull itself out of this mess if it doesn't work together. And right now, it really doesn't seem to want to work together.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point you make about the vaccines and the countries that have that reject other vaccines in terms of allowing quarantine or allowing you into to avoid quarantine when you arrive in a country. There's an interesting case in the US at the moment right now, because the US President Biden has said that they want to help India. They want to provide more vaccines that they won't be using, which is the AstraZeneca vaccine. They have a supply of those they're going to send to India. But I didn't realize this, that the AstraZeneca vaccine is not FDA approved, so it can't be used at the moment in the US anyway. But it also means that they can't be exported to India to help what is a critical situation, because the export guarantee is not there because it's not FDA approved. So, you know, these kinds of things just highlight the difficulties of just what seems very, very simple, a humanitarian help to a country that is in dire need. It actually can't happen for legislative reasons. And these kinds of things just kind of show that reopening travel is just going to be so, so complicated. I think you asked me earlier about one of the most overlooked developments. I would say in our region, although it's not in Southeast Asia, the fact that the Tokyo Olympics announced, a couple of months ago, that travelers would not be allowed to come in, would not be able to attend the sporting events. It seems symbolic because it's a sporting fiesta and it's the safest decision, of course. There may well be Japanese spectators in the crowds that we don't know at the moment. And teams do look like they're going to be turning up to attend the games. But I think it was an element of around the region, this further eroded trust that it is safe to travel. Even if Japan had put in place very, very strict protocols that people could only attend for the period during the games, and then they would have to leave again. That wasn't deemed safe enough to do. And I think that has further eroded confidence around the region.
Yeah, agreed. So it wouldn't be the Southeast Asia travel show if we didn't talk about travel bubbles. So, Gary, are they even relevant anymore now that we have vaccines?
Okay, I'm going to throw this one back to you, Hannah, because you've asked me most of the questions first off. So I'm going to throw this one back to you. What do you think?
I think that they still will be. Especially if we're looking at vaccination rollouts across Southeast Asia. If we're talking specifically about Southeast Asia and travel bubbles, yes, I think they're going to be relevant. Because in all likelihood, the vaccination rollout won't be completed. I mean, many governments are saying the end of this year. Let's say it's more likely by H1 next year. So you're still going to have this situation where many, many travellers are not vaccinated. And you are hopefully going to be in a situation where countries want to reopen travel, in which case they've got to kind of match those two things. But we may see that vaccinations kind of ease some of those requirements. So perhaps you would qualify to take less tests, for example. Or maybe you've got slightly easier conditions to enter. But even Singapore said, I think earlier in the week when they announced the Singapore-Hong Kong air travel bubble, that vaccinations is not the main thing that they're looking at right now when they're setting up these air travel bubbles. It's the level of COVID cases in the country rather than necessarily the rate of vaccination. What do you think, Gary?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question because, you know, if we always kind of defer back to the original travel bubble concept, which is Australia and New Zealand, and you look at how they've managed their bubble, and it took them so long, basically a year, to make it two-way. And that's pretty much because both countries, New Zealand especially, Australia's come towards it a little bit later, are basically zero COVID. That is their strategies, is to just drive the virus out of the country and to keep it out. So therefore, the travel between the two countries is on the basis not of vaccinations, but the fact that they are totally safe for each other's residents because there's no COVID in each country. You know, that can change, of course. This virus is just so devious and so volatile. But then you look at Hong Kong and Singapore, and that's going to be managed quite differently. You know, there's vaccinations from one side, from the Hong Kong side to Singapore. Singapore, as you said, is looking at it in a different way. It's looking at how the virus is managed in different destinations. But, you know, that changes. As I said a few moments ago, you know, if you'd have gone back 5 or 6 months, you know, Laos, Cambodia, probably Thailand would be in the mix for a travel bubble with most countries across the region. But right now they wouldn't be. You also look at other countries in our region like Indonesia, Philippines and Malaysia. None of those three countries have been able to get a handle on the virus at all. Indonesia and Philippines, I think, are understandable just because of the size of their populations. But you look at Malaysia. Malaysia is a really curious case because, you know, had this incredible lockdown, very strict lockdown for 7 weeks last year. Looked to have really got a handle on it. But since September, October last year, the numbers just haven't come down. And, you know, we have a relatively open society here. We can do most things day to day. We can't travel domestically and we can't travel internationally. But I'm still surprised that those numbers haven't come down. And, you know, that obviously puts Malaysia at the back of the queue when you're looking at travel bubbles with other countries that, like Singapore, are going to be measuring how they deal with travel bubbles in future on the basis of managing the virus. So at the moment, which countries in Southeast Asia would be on anybody's radar to do a travel bubble? I mean, it's getting quite limited, isn't it? You'd probably say Singapore, Vietnam, Brunei. Would there be any others?
No, I think that's it, isn't it? Everybody else is going through another wave of cases right now. Maybe we'll see a Singapore, Vietnam air travel bubble. That would be nice.
Yeah, I mean, we've been hoping for that for quite a while, haven't we, both of us? Well, that's something we've been saying we would like to see happen, because I think that really would give some impetus, wouldn't it? That really would. And your Singaporeans would definitely want to travel to Vietnam. Vietnamese, I'm sure, would want to take short trips to Singapore. But the likelihood of it happening, I'm not convinced.
Yeah, slim from Vietnam's side, I think.
But in terms of travel bubbles going forward, Hannah, you know, do you think that concept, you know, there are various ways of looking at of travel bubbles, as we've just said. Do you think that concept will become more flexible, so it is more of a green zone travel rather than a bubble? Now, you look at Bali, for instance, was looking at reopening with, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 markets that are considered sort of low-risk countries coming in. I don't know whether you would call that a bubble or whether you would call that sort of a green zone corridor. But, you know, it's definitely going to be based on management of the virus and safety for travelers coming in.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, initially, yes, maybe it will be a kind of two-way thing. But like you say, eventually it is going to have to expand. And, you know, like we were saying, the Trans-Tasman bubble, can Singapore be added to that? Maybe. So there's going to be all kinds of permutations. There's going to be all kinds of names for it as well, I think, depending on the country. But they're here to stay.
Yeah. And also the purpose of travel as well. When you look at sort of Phuket or Bali, you know, that's very much about, you said this before, is very much about inbound travel, you know, bringing back leisure travelers, trying to bring more people in to service the inbound economy. Whereas, you know, the bubbles that we're talking about in terms of Singapore and Hong Kong, you know, they're going to have strong visit family and friends components. They're going to have strong business travel components. There will be some leisure in there as well. I think the same is probably can be said about Australia and New Zealand right now. But when you're looking to open a destination purely for leisure, it's just a whole different conundrum, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Hannah, we've come to the last question. I'm going to throw this one to you first up. Realistically, what are your expectations in terms of travel and tourism in Southeast Asia by the end of 2021? And do you think for things to change, there needs to be a kind of turning point?
It's so hard to look into my crystal ball. But I think, you know, we are going to see some inbound travel starting, I think, on a slightly larger scale, perhaps in Q4. And I'm thinking particularly of Bali, Phuket. And I do think somehow these schemes are going to get up off the ground. Just there's just really that determination you can see this time around for them to really happen. I think one of the other turning points is going to be once we start reaching that phase of mass vaccination rollout. So many countries in Southeast Asia, you know, maybe barring Singapore and perhaps Indonesia as well, you know, most of the countries right now are still prioritizing frontline workers. They're still prioritizing the elderly. They haven't got onto the general public. And perhaps once we start to really see vaccinations pick up, the speed of it, the age groups coming down and down and down, hopefully, obviously, that's going to have an impact on the number of cases, but also just in general confidence as well. I mean, and we've seen that with countries like the UK, like Israel, as their vaccination rates have increased. You know, overall confidence is really is increasing in tandem with that, and I think that's what the region needs. Well, what's your take?
You mentioned there some of the markets or the countries that are sped ahead with vaccinations, and you know, I think the US and China are the two that have the most numbers of vaccines in arms at the moment. The difference, of course, is that the percentage of population is so different because the actual total populations are so much larger. Now, I think, you know, we back in the early days of COVID, we talked a lot about the regionalization of travel, that, you know, maybe we will only see short-haul travel in the near future. But you know, I think the world will be looking to the US to see what demand will be like for travel overseas from American travelers when more of them are vaccinated. Will they be willing to travel longer haul? It's possibly doubtful if you look at, you know, go back over history after 9/11. There was a long lag before Americans were traveling long haul in any numbers. They may travel to Europe, they may travel domestically, they may travel to the Caribbean. But, you know, if Americans come back to our region, you know, I think that would be a big shot in the arm for the travel industry. Ditto China. And we don't really know when China's going to reopen its outbound air gates. But until China does, you know, travel and tourism in this region will be at a much lower level than it could otherwise be. You know, it was the number one inbound market for most countries across Southeast Asia. So those are the kind of things that we'll be looking at. Both of those have a lot of leverage in terms of how they could allow their travelers to partially travel again. But, you know, without those happening, we're not going to see great numbers of intra-ASEAN travel, I think, because I think it's just going to be too difficult. I don't really see countries opening their borders at any way to their neighboring countries apart from Singapore, because I just don't think the trust is there. Do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. I do see intra-ASEAN travel being one of the, I wouldn't say the last one to come back, but sure, certainly not one of the first kind of regions to come back. And, you know, we've seen US travelers traveling. Yeah, their market is speeding ahead, like you say. And it's going to be a lot about whether Southeast Asia has the COVID-19 situation under control and is able to be on the green lists as well for these outbound travel markets. So, you know, right now, I think the CDC have put do not travel or not permitted to travel advisories for much of the region. It will be as that starts to change and Americans will start to travel, hopefully, because they'll be able to get the insurance coverage to be able to do that too. That would make the change. But I think you're right. I think the biggest change actually will be China. Yeah, because that's just what everybody, you know, this time last year, I think that's what we were talking about the most. And it's kind of tailed off because I think everybody has not given up hope, but just kind of accepted that that's not going to happen in the short term. But yeah, I think the moment that it looks like China is ramping up and going to let their travelers back out again, we're going to see a lot of green shoots.
Yeah, until then, it's not a pretty picture, is it?
No. So on that positive note, that brings us to the end of this week's edition of the show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments about what we discussed or what we missed out. Drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yep. Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com. or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
That's a wrap for this week, and we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you very soon.